think they're doing the last-minute scurry there.
Yeah, we're all set, Lynn. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Well, we're up here in the Santa Barbara Mountains, so you have the floor.
You are. Okay. You got them up in the mountains, huh? To get away from the smell of the baby boomers, huh? Say when.
Take it away.
Okay. Well, let's do something a little different than I often do today, because I've often done what I've often done, and therefore maybe it's time to do what I have not often done. All right, I want to refer your attention to a book which was intended to be the first of two volumes, but only one was produced for nasty reasons. We had a former associate deceased recently, Graham Lowry. Now, Graham Lowry was not only a professional historian of unusually accomplished as a thinker about history, American history in particular, that is, unlike most so-called historians, he actually relived the history, not merely as a history of facts, but as living history. For similar reasons, I have forbidden people on the West Coast of the United States, or East Coast rather, to produce plays, because their conception of drama is romantic. It's a fantasy life, an escape, like a Hollywood escape from reality into an imaginary place in the past. And you would use for your, like, doll play and dollhouse, you would use the names and some descriptions of actual figures in the past to play dollhouse with a past part of history, particularly like Shakespeare's plays or those of Schiller. The baby boomer, generally, who's a romantic, cannot understand history and always tries to play it like a game of dollhouse, taking the names of actual living people from the past and putting them in the dollhouse and playing with them and imagine that they were changing the game. This doll will do this. This doll will do this. I will intervene. I will change the way this doll plays, and everything will then work out just fine because I've changed history. And so they do that. But Graham was not like that. Graham was a person who lived history as I do. I mean, my attempt is always to relive the experience of the history which happened, not to try to change it, but to learn from the experience to understand it and to recognize that history is a part of my past. The romantic never really understands, accepts the fact that it was part of the past. They like to live in a fantasy world and escape from real life, as with a Hollywood film. But Graham was a real historian who really lived history. One day he came to me in the 1983 and said he'd made a discovery in history. He said the question that bothered him was, since the American Revolution, and he knew a good deal about it, because he knew the history of the 17th century in the United States, or what became the United States, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony and so forth. And he knew some later history. And he knew the role of Leibniz in making the American Revolution. The question that was posed in his mind was, how did the ideas of Leibniz, as transmitted after the beginning of the 18th century, how do these ideas how were they actually transmitted into the life of the United States in the circles of Franklin and so forth? And how did the United States, how was it born? So understanding that, he did a research into the history of England at a particular point between 1688 and 1716. And this formed the core of what became this book, which is called "As How the Nation Was Won." In the process, he came across the one figure in English history, which was most typical of the link between the Leibnizian tradition of the continent and the Leibnizian tradition of Benjamin Franklin in founding the United States and defining the economic policy of the United States. The figure he discovered was Jonathan Swift. A Jonathan Swift is somebody you should find out about for yourself. We've written a good deal about it. Graham's book refers to it. But there's one particular thing I would like to call to your attention. Look at in the one of the volumes of Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, The Voyage to Laputa, which is itself a joke on the question of the Spanish, and so forth. The 7th and 8th and 10th chapters, which have some interesting references in them, which you will understand after you read it. But let me call your attention to the 10th chapter of A Voyage to Laputa, or Laputa. In this, Swift introduces a very ugly but interesting type of character, which he calls the Schuldbrug. Now, these are people who were actually correspond to what many of you might describe as the forerunner of the typical modern baby boomer, particularly the baby boomer who is now past 50, 55 years of age. These Schuldbrugs are the so-called quasi-immortals. And Swift will have some real fun with this, because at first he says, immortality. How wonderful. This is his character, Gulliver. How wonderful. These people live a long life. Why don't I find more of them around advising the monarchy here, the local monarchy? They must have tremendous amount of experience and are able to give good advice from the lessons of history to the monarchy. But the leading people of that kingdom that he was visiting said, you don't understand. And therefore, Gulliver, the character, found out about the Schuldbrugs. And he found out they're born with a certain patch over the eye. But then at the age of 40, they're put under special prohibitions, because they begin to become senile. And they keep on living up to 200 years of age. They become just a real mean-spirited nuisance hanging around. And they have all kinds of restrictions on them to make sure they don't have too much influence over the younger generation. As a matter of fact, none is preferred. The Schuldbrugs are very tragic. And you reading this, you will say, this is the typical modern baby boomer. Now, the question is, can you save a baby boomer from his fate as a putative, potential Schuldbrug? I have a great deal of experience in trying to do that. It's extremely difficult labor. We do, however, have a few successes, and we do try to rescue as many of our own Schuldbrugs in our own association as possible. I'm not a Schuldbrug. I'm mortal. But, you know, as I've described earlier, when people get past male menopause, which comes about 52, 53, 55 years of age, the whole tribe, all these families of approaching this part of life, they suddenly go into withdrawal from reality. They go into a kind of purgatory where they sit knitting to pass the time of day, because they've entered the end of history, just like the Schuldbrugs in Gulliver's story. They don't believe in the future. Now, the practical problem this represents is this. In any society in which we are composed of mortal people, that is, we all die, the meaning of our lives as human beings, as distinct from monkeys and some kinds of baby boomers, is what we pass on in terms of ideas and institutions and experience from our lives and the lives of those who have gone before us into the work and the continuity of history, society, of culture, the progress of humanity, represented by the coming generation. And not only do we depend upon young children, babies, children, adolescents, who are part, of course, of the biological history, the other history of our society, but we look especially to people who actually reach about the age of 18 to 25. Now, in that generation, 18 to 25, which is the nominal age interval of most of our limb members, you reach the highest level of creativity, of adult creativity. That is, prior to about the age of 18, in adolescence, people may have a high potential for creativity, often do, very active young minds. But they don't have a sense of adulthood. So the age interval from 18 to 25 is the interval in which we usually find the most gifted adult minds in terms of rate of creativity. After the age of 25, about 27 or so forth, normally in society today, the creativity begins to die away. Learning is accumulated, but creativity wanes. About the time a college graduate goes through the master's degree program, gets a degree, gets a job, or goes through the doctorate, which is even more destructive, they lose their creativity. There's a famous series of writings on this by a famous psychiatrist, Lawrence Kuby, on the neurotic distortion of the creative process. I'm a specialist in this area and have written a great deal about it. That you observe that somewhere between 25 and 30, the rate of creativity among adults tends to drop off. Not necessarily. There are lawful exceptions to that drop-off. When I found people around me, for example, of my generation, who were actually creative when I knew them not only as adolescents but as young adults, and I watched their creativity vanish and drop away. I've seen the same thing in our association, that people who came to join with me back in the 1970s, for example, came in as young, fruitfully creative people. And as the 1980s came on, their creativity began to drop precipitously. We still had a lot of creativity. We selectively had selective creativity among creative personalities. We had, for example, Professor Moon, a very creative person up at the time he died, a great scientist. And so creativity does not naturally die out as you become older, but in our society it tends to die out for cultural and biological reasons. I would say that if you have the biological capacity for creativity, from my own experience, my own work, that if you do your creativity constantly, if you work at it constantly, you keep your creativity alive. But once you begin to slide off and say, I have no new ideas to learn, I have facts to learn, not ideas, I am perfected. I don't have to develop myself anymore. I'm a developed personality whom I admire very much. And I wouldn't want to tamper with this perfection I've already achieved. The biological processes of creativity seem to vanish too, gradually. They erode. Whereas people who maintain a high degree of creative activity into their 60s and 70s and beyond tend to remain biologically mentally active. Whereas people who do not do that fade away intellectually and morally. Now, what happened because of what was done to us in terms of persecution? You know, they tried to kill me, they sent me to prison, that sort of thing. That a lot of people associated with me began to lose their creativity. And all, shall we say, about the middle of the 1970s, or the 1990s. And it began to vanish. And, of course, this coincided with the time that many of them who had been joined the association back in the 1970s were now past the age of male menopause, which is very dangerous. Female menopause is not intrinsically dangerous. Male menopause, intellectual menopause, is very dangerous. And we had a lot of it. So you had a phenomenon. So when you read this chapter 10 of The Voyage to Laputa, you're going to think about the Struldbrugs and realize that we have some of them among us in society. For example, you take the case of these guys who are now going to jail and being marched to jail from the highest-ranking positions in corporations and so forth. These are Struldbrugs. They're moral Struldbrugs. They have no morality whatsoever, no creativity. They're absolutely useless parasites. We could manage GM better if we got rid of the whole top management and let some of the trade unionists who work in the joint, leading trade unionists, take over and run the plant. It would run much better because they're capable of doing the job. Whereas the top management, the financial management with the big retirement bonuses, these guys are absolutely useless parasites who couldn't care less. And many of the stockholders are just as bad. They're in there not to invest in the future by building the future through the corporation's progress. They're in there, hit and run from one stock to the next, one day to the next. Where can I get a little more? Where can I get another inch of profit out of this thing? Completely parasites. So the danger is how do we deal with a society with all these baby boomers who tend to behave like Jonathan Swift's Struldbrugs? And that's our problem. So a characteristic which I can advise you on as a personal psychological advisor, you don't want to become a Struldbrug. Now, if you don't want to become a Struldbrug, you have to start being a non-Struldbrug today. And that involves being creative, actually creative as we define creativity. This means actually mastering physical science, not learning in a university what they teach you, but actually living as Graham lived history, as living history. Relive the experience of discovery. You don't know anything unless you have relived it. Don't be a romantic playing with what you pick up as secondhand ideas. And also take the challenge. Take the challenge sometimes of a danger situation, as I've done many times. I find danger is very stimulating. Not masochistically, but it's stimulating because it forces you to respond to the challenge of a threat. And that is very good for keeping your creative juices going. You take the case of a very famous fellow, old Moltke, who ran the Prussian military with quite some success and retired. I think it was about the age of 88. And he was pretty effective all the way through. If someone may criticize, as Bismarck might have done, criticize some of Moltke's enthusiasms for war. He sometimes carried it too far. But he was very excellent at military science, understood how a military had to function, and he kept his juices flowing and was still active, and said, about the age of 88, I've got to retire. He was still the commander-in-chief of the Prussian military and the German military. So what I would say is don't get in the idea of being a practical person. That's the worst thing that can happen to you. Don't be impractical. Be concerned with the reality of life. But never try to pass yourself off as a practical guy who knows how to do things. Always accept the fact that you are insufficiently developed, that you're still a little bit childish. And that's a good thing, to be somewhat childish, to feel that you are imperfect, that you have to struggle hard to overcome your ignorance, to master the challenge you thought you couldn't master before. If you think you're an expert in physical science, master classical music. If you think you're an expert in classical music, master physical science. If you think you're an expert in history, master it, relive it, and so forth and so on. And that's what I think the limb should be. I believe that one of the missions of the limb is from time to time to try to rescue a member of the baby boomer generation or two. It'll be very useful to do that. If we can get some of these old fogies who've gone into quasi-purgatory where they knit waiting for the trap door to be sprung on them, if you get them back active again, they do have a few things they can contribute to the process of getting society moving ahead. Now, if you can inspire them to come back to life, you're doing a good job. Now, take, for example, what happened in Washington this week on Thursday. We had a pack of trade unionists who were in for the webcast and for the events of the day following. Because of this, we had appointments on Capitol Hill with members of the Houses of Congress, and which a few trade unionists and the like, together with a pack of youth, of singing youth, of about the 90 we had there, went in teams into the Congress, into congressional offices. Now, what happened is this. A good trade union leader of the type we have is a very valuable person, much more valuable than the typical management type, because they've come through the trade union movement, and if they're not corrupt, they really have learned how the business of organizing society. Now, over the course of time, many of them have become worn down because the labor movement has been worn down. It hasn't been too much. But they kept alive the spirit, the organizing spirit, the political organizing spirit, and other things of the best of the labor movement. Now, when you get them together with a mixture of energetic young people of the type of the 90-odd we had going into the Congress this past week, they come back to life, full life, because they understand fully what our youth movement typifies. They understand that our youth movement represents the life, the future life or prospect of life of this society. And they know that when you take experienced people who have not gone dead, who have not become Stroldbrooks simply by the virtue of age, when you put that together, those types of people who are alive, feisty, leading, together with the youth movement, and when these people have the understanding, that is the older ones, have the understanding to turn youth loose. Not to turn them loose in a wild way, but to let them express themselves, because the habits, the way, the culture of the young adult generation is different than the culture of the older generation. And therefore, when people from the tweener, older, or baby generation, as trade union movement people with experience, encounter youth, they treat it the way they treated organizing. You let the energy and impetus and impulses of the young people guide you in playing your role. You don't try to impose your ideas upon them, on young people. You let the energy, the cultural impetus of the younger people become more effective. You help them be what they are. The problem with the baby boomer, the reason I keep baby boomers away from youth boomers as much as possible, because when youth become the handmaidens of baby boomers, the youth are destroyed. And I will not allow baby boomers to take direction of youth, because the baby boomers instinctively do not understand young people. They will either drive them away or destroy them, because they want to impose baby boomer ideology upon a different generation. Whereas the trade unionists, maybe from the baby boomer generation, But the trade union leaders of the type we've been dealing with are not baby boomers in that sense. They understand the organizing process. And when you're organizing with a mass of people, say of a different nation or a different generation, you let the natural impulses, the natural needs of that younger generation express itself. What you do is you try to help them to channel their impulses, their character, into directions which are well advised. So you advise them, and you provide some leadership, but you don't try to dominate them. The people who try to dominate the young belong to the category that Jonathan Swift describes, when not as yahoos, as another variety, another tragic variety, the Stroldbrooks. Okay, that's what I have to say.
Got some questions, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
My question is in regards to a dialogue of cultures. And we were thinking of how you can't necessarily just say we have a plan for your country or your continent. You actually have to have a dialogue upon where you figure out why this development is necessary. And so I was wondering about some of these cultures that have been literally destroyed, not just in the sense of degeneration, but where you've had the orchestration of massive genocide, where you actually have these different, you know, tribes or ethnicities massacring each other.
Yeah.
And so my question was, how do you approach a society which knows only hell and misery, or a society in which you have individuals where their identity becomes based on how demonic they can be to other human beings? How would you actually approach having a dialogue with these people so that you could have this development around the world?
Okay, well, let's get concrete. First of all, you have a big problem with this, which did not exist in the same way when I was young. It's a problem which was developed in the post-war period, beginning with the death of Roosevelt. Now, as you know, or could have observed from study, the children who were born to my generation, that is, people who were born about 1945 or slightly later, the so-called baby boomers today, were subjected, as I've described it frequently, to two general conditions. First of all, under Truman, they were subjected to a terror of being plunged into the threat of a general nuclear war. The United States and the United Kingdom were committed, after the death of Roosevelt, to taking our powers to a preemptive nuclear war against the Soviet Union for the purpose of establishing an empire called world government. That was the policy enunciated by Bertrand Russell, who was called a great pacifist because he wanted to kill so many people, who proposed this policy of preemptive nuclear warfare, which was U.S. policy under the President Truman administration and also the British administration of the same period. Now, therefore, in my generation, was terrified. I wasn't terrified. I was angry. I didn't lack fear of the situation, but I was not terrified. I saw about 80% or more of my generation who'd come back from war, and men were turned into cowards by their wives nagging them, "Don't get our family into trouble." So now the children who were born to these returning veterans in that same generation, especially those who went into suburbia, were brainwashed by an institution called the Congress for Cultural Freedom. This group of ex-Marxists and so forth, and still Marxists, which were the antecedent of the neocon phenomenon today, they ran the culture and sought to destroy it. Now, one of the key things they emphasized was the so-called doctrine of the authoritarian personality. that anybody who believed in truth was considered an authoritarian. You cannot have truth in society. You must have consideration for popular opinion. Now, the precedent for this is what the Persians did to try to destroy Greece through the cult of Delphi, the Apollo cult. The phenomenon became sophistry of a Greek people who no longer believed in truth, but believed in what was called democracy, popular opinion. And you find that in Western Europe in particular, and the United States, the generation of people who were born after the war were the people who were the victims, because they were conditioned to this in every way, in detail, in kindergarten, in school, in television, and so forth. So the idea of democracy, or the whole idea of democracy as participatory democracy, for example, the 1960s, and the policies of the 1970s afterward, produced a generation which does not believe in truth as truth and believes in adapting to popular opinion. Now, this today has two aspects. The baby boomer generation, on the one hand, the Strollbrooks, demand that their popular opinion, the popular opinion of their generation, be imposed upon the youth. And that's why baby boomers cannot get along with youth. That's why parents who are baby boomers cannot associate in an intelligent way with their own children who are now young adults. That's the conflict between the young people today and the baby boomers. That the baby boomers are a bunch of tyrants in the same way that the Democratic Party of Athens, which committed the judicial murder of Socrates, were tyrants. And there's no difference in principle between the baby boomer generation, even in our own organization, in this respect, and the young people. That's why I've kept the young youth movement away from the baby boomers' clutches as much as possible. Because a baby boomer, by nature, cannot possibly understand how to function on the basis of truth. Now, we have people in our association who did learn something about truth and did represent it. But in terms of culture, in terms of their participation in the culture in which they live, they have adapted to the culture. And the culture is a decadent, degenerate culture. All right. Now, therefore, when you start talking about relations with other parts of the world and helping them, the danger is that today that is understood to mean being a baby boomer or like a baby boomer and treating a different culture. It means treating the other culture the way the baby boomer treats the young adult today. And that's what you have to avoid. What is required is leadership. For example, let's take the case of the world in general, the developing sector. You have terrible conditions there. Now, what are you going to do? Are you going to act like a baby boomer would, that is a democracy in the sense of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, of trying to adapt to these cultures? Now, what do you have? You have, in Asian culture, typically about 70% of the population of Asian cultures is oppressed by their own society with greater intensity and cruelty than those cultures are oppressed by European imperialism. That's today. So therefore, a sort of a consensual attitude about ideas will not work. What you have to do instead is what you would hope that parents would do with their children. Would love them. And therefore, what you have to express is love for the well-being of the personality of the people of these cultures, such as Asian cultures. You have to recognize, yes, they have some stupid things in their culture. There is stupid things in their culture which are inferior to the standards of European culture, which are the worst and most immediate oppression, source of oppression in those societies. So you can't take the stupid attitude that some people do of saying, well, it's European culture that is oppressing these societies. No. Imperialism was able to work. European imperialism was able to work because these societies have already oppressed themselves. And the European colonialists moved in to exploit the innate oppression of that culture to get these people to victimize themselves. And they were victimized because they allowed themselves, in general, with some exceptions, to be victimized. Because they accepted the methods of victimization introduced by the British and other colonial powers, which had learned how to use the flaws in the culture of the oppressed people to oppress them. The case in India, the case throughout the areas. In Africa, it was a similar kind of thing. It was more cruel, vicious. So therefore, what we have to be concerned about is two things. First of all, we have to love humanity in a real sense. We have to love all parts of humanity in a real sense. But we have to understand also that the thing that will help humanity is the truth, which includes the scientific truth, which includes the truth about culture, the truth about art, and so forth. So therefore, we have to actually express love for humanity by never compromising with the truth. And that's where the problem comes today, the great danger today, where people say, let us stop oppressing these people, but then they go turn around and unwittingly promote the very things which are the perpetuation of the very oppression they would like to remove.
Yes, hello, Lynn.
Yeah.
I have two questions, actually. One may sound a little strange, and you and maybe others might not understand why I'm asking it. I know my intention is good. There are problems that I see sometimes with people, and relationships. And I'm wondering, in intimate relationships, often the personal becomes political or is political. And you've mentioned some cases through history, Henry VII or Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, James and Dolly Madison. So my first question is there a scientific method by which to determine whether an intimate relationship is healthy or destructive? Okay, and then my second question is, do you have any ideas as to who would be a suitable vice president to replace Cheney, and or are you in consultation with various parties on that matter?
Well, on the second question, I have a generic approach to this. Yes, I do have. I've expressed this. I said, obviously, we're going to have a scramble. In the first case, the immediate objective is get rid of Cheney. Because if you get rid of Cheney, you've taken the worst problem under control. That is in the executive branch. Bush is a nothing. The poor guy is a nothing. Getting rid of Cheney will eliminate about 90% of the problem. And you have a situation which what we're getting in terms of information now is that, as McCain will probably express this in part in his way on the Republican side, there is a general impulse to clean house of the Cheney apparatus and of the Karl Rove apparatus and so forth in the White House. This is a complicated process because to do this without going through the formality of impeachment means you have to negotiate. And it has to be bipartisan, and you have to have a Republican component which takes the spearhead in dumping Cheney. Because Cheney is normally a Republican property, and you got to dump the guy. and it has to be dumped in a certain way with the consent of the Republican Party or the leadership. Getting DeLay and his crowd out of control of the House of Representatives is a key part of this. All right, now, therefore, you're going to anticipate getting a new vice president. My view would be, and I've expressed this, that perhaps the best thing to do is to have a Republican from the Senate replace Cheney as vice president. I mean, a Democrat from the Senate replace Cheney as vice president. Why? Because when it comes to the overall bipartisan negotiation, when the question of Bush deciding he's going to retire coming up, and that can happen, Bush, without Cheney, might decide he's much happier and more comfortable as being a former president than being an incumbent president with the headaches that involves. So therefore, but the Republican Party will want a Republican president. That would mean getting a Republican out of the Senate as a replacement for Bush. But that does not mean these things are going to happen simultaneously. It means we have to get Cheney out first. Therefore, in anticipation of the fact that the incumbent president might desire actually to retire with a clean bill, shall we say, that would mean that in maintaining the continuity of the executive branch, they would want a Republican, probably from the Senate. And I would think that if that selection is done properly for these replacements, that would be about the best deal we could get. Now, actually, I would be much better than any of these guys, but that's a different story. Better qualified. The problem now is, as you see, we had some good work done by the Senate in the course of the year to date in dealing with some of the worst problems and the worst threats. We saw a good bipartisan impulse developing in the Senate. We didn't get much in the House because the House was dominated by this bunch of Gingrichites, including this fascist DeLay. But the problem, even if we get the House improved by removing the DeLay factor, even with both houses of the Congress functioning in a healthy way, we still can't solve the problem that confronts us right now. We need a presidency. Our system requires a presidency. What you get is you get foolishness from citizens and also from legislators. They'll say, well, what bill do you want us to put through? What legislation, what law should we pass? I say, come on, grow up. Ours is a presidential constitutional system. We have a preamble of the Constitution, which is the highest form of law of our republic. Therefore, if we have a problem, such as a threat of an attack as in a war, or some other, the bodies of government do not go through the procedure of enacting a law. They may make a law, but they respond to the reality of the situation according to the implicit requirements of the federal Constitution. Those implicit requirements are, first of all, the preamble, and secondly, the other features of the structure of government. So we defend, first of all, the preamble of the Constitution, uphold that, and at the same time, we do that in a way which conforms to the other constitutional features. And we modify law as required by those imperatives. That's how our system works. You need a presidency. My judgment of history is if you have two qualified people as a president and vice president heading up the executive branch, and you have a mission orientation accepted by the leadership of the Congress and the presidency, we are capable of handling the problems that the United States faces immediately and handling them in a way which gives leadership to the world, which the world at this time needs. Because no other part of the world except the United States could possibly solve the mess that's coming down on us now. With the leadership of the United States, other parts of the world will be able to and will be necessary to solve this mess. But we have to be the spark plug. So that's my view on that. My view is that my advice to these bodies is now absolutely crucial to their success. For example, you see what happened. Earlier this year, I warned that the collapse of the automotive industry was the single biggest threat and dealt with the fact that the pension problem was the secondary feature of this. The aircraft industry, the air travel industry, was a secondary feature of this, also the same problem. But some people went to members of the Congress, the Senate in particular, who were interested in what I had to say, and turned them off and said, LaRouche wants to form, as was said during the webcast recently, this discussion, LaRouche wants to nationalize, that is to make a public corporation out of the auto industry, to say that, oh, this guy's a communist. And that was used as a rumor to try to get me out of the picture. So therefore, the Congress did nothing. I devised the policy. Now we come to the point in October, the industry is disintegrating. The pension system is disintegrating. The aircraft industry is disintegrating. And all those months in which something could have been done to prevent this state of affairs have been wasted. So therefore, it's obvious that the institutions of the federal government have not reached the point they're able to function without the kind of initiative which I supply to these institutions. So while I'm outside government, I'm essential to the government. And in defining what the government must become, you have to include my role as a key feature of shaping the kinds of ideas which must inform the decisions of that government. Now, as to other things, on this more personal side of the thing, there's only one remedy. You know, people get, when they think of themselves as living and dying, and they have a certain sexual heat seizes them, they tend to plunge into imprudent arrangements out of their desire for sex or something, or comfort, the comfort that goes with marriage. They make a romantic fantasy out of marriage, not realizing that it's something, an institution which, like the government, has to be built up, and that the selection of candidacies for that marriage is fairly important. Now, you've gotten into a society in which marriage is no longer an institution, it's a revolving door. And relationships in general, of sexual relationships, of so-called partnerships, are pretty much a revolving door. You keep changing your relationships. Well, none of them seems to work. And who's to blame? They're all to blame. Because the conception of the nature of the human individual under the conditions of culture, which have been developed in the post-war period, especially out of the 1950s change in culture, and especially out of the baby boomer, the 1968er phenomenon, it's almost impossible to have a stable relationship because the idea with which people go into these relationships is poisoned to begin with. So you have to start looking at the generations as victims of the poisoning of the idea of relationships. Now, for example, we're now in a get sex quick generation phase, and that makes everything terrible. So don't worry about the qualifications of the other person. You have to worry about the cultural standard. Now, the only way to cure this thing is not by saying marriage counseling or whatever the equivalent may be for that substitute. What you have to do is to think about the development of the personality. And you want relationships with developed personalities. And since you're not one yourself, you've got to accept the burden of undergoing some development and expect that it's in the process of sharing that development that you will find out who and with what you want to work. I would say that you have to think of yourself as being immortal, as I do. Not that you don't die, but that your personality has to be immortal. And you have to think of what you're doing with your life. And when you take a trip with somebody, make sure that you've chosen the same destination.
This question is mostly historical.
Speak up, I can't hear you.
Oh, sorry about that. this question is a historical question. It gives you a chance to kind of get back to ancient history a little bit. My question is, we learn a lot about history in this organization, predominantly European history. And from what I've heard about why we don't learn about Eastern history, like Chinese history specifically, is that they never reached the same kind of advancement as European civilization. They never got to that point of thinking about the common good, and I think you sort of got into that a little bit in the first question today. Mm-hmm. So I guess the question is, ancient Chinese history was one of the oldest histories that we know about, and they developed a system of writing, they developed a system of advanced agriculture, they kept histories, they had philosophers like Confucius, for instance. I guess the question is, in that ancient sense, how might Chinese civilization have been influenced, or rather have influenced Western civilization?
Well, Chinese civilization, of course, there is an ancient Chinese civilization, or what an ancient antecedent for what we call Chinese civilization today. The expression of Confucius and some other things are an expression of ancient astronomy, Chinese astronomy, are expressions of that culture. But don't romanticize Chinese culture by exclusion. You have to realize that there are many advanced cultures on this planet, not just Chinese cultures. Some of these advanced cultures have in a sense, disappeared from our ken, even though their impact still exists. For example, as I've emphasized repeatedly, the root of civilization, as we know it, did not come from inland cultures. The root of civilization came from ocean-going maritime cultures. Other cultures, which were inland cultures, tend to be backward, except as they were civilized by the impact of maritime culture. That is, man as a cultured man, as a civilization, is essentially a creature of the sea, not of inland culture. What happened is that development of culture, which started from the sea, moved inland, first of all, along coasts, which were always a base for maritime cultures. Then they moved into rivers, especially the lower part of large river systems. And then as technology progressed, they moved further and further inland. The dominant cultures of the planet up to the present day, or at least up until the development of the transcontinental railroad system in the United States, were predominantly maritime cultures. Other cultures were backward. Now, I have another factor, which also occurs in China culture. It also is traced and you find it in ancient antecedents of Indian culture. The specific characteristic of European civilization, which is its continuity and its distinction from the rest of the world civilization, is the development of the ideas, of the cultural ideas, associated with the Pythagoreans, Thales, Solon, and Plato. And so it is this development within Greek society, which was brought about by the development of the maritime culture of the Mediterranean region, which was consolidated in Egypt and given to the Greeks from Egypt. So European civilization actually is traced from the specific influence of the Pythagoreans, Thales, Solon, Plato, and so forth. That's European civilization, that very specific root. No other part of the planet within historic times has developed that kind of culture, although you can find abundant evidence of the same conception of man within Indian culture, within China culture, and so forth. But you don't find it as a developed systemic cultural phenomenon. The struggle in European civilization, starting from ancient Greece, the classical movement in ancient Greece, typified by Plato, the struggle to bring into being a European culture which had these was characteristics as a dominant feature was postponed, essentially, until the 15th century Renaissance. Then their counterforce, in representing the Persian or Babylonian tradition through Rome, through Venice, and so forth, was entered. So now we have European civilization as a conflict between two forces. One, the Babylonian legacy, typified by the British Empire and by people in the United States who follow the British Empire, shall we say, as opposed to what our Constitution represents as a product of the legacy from Solon and Pythagoreans through and Plato to the time present time. So that's the difference. There are other. The problem is that the dominant culture of today, of the world today, the culture which is required to maintain the existing level of world population, is European culture. We're reminded of this when we look at the fact that 70% of the population of India lives in terrible and presently worsening conditions. So that India is not a successful society. It is a nation with successful features. But the failure to deal with the 70% of extreme poverty represents failure. In China, you have success, as a recent rapid and successful development under Deng Xiaoping reforms. But the 70% poverty factor has not been cured. And this is what China is wrestling with today. So therefore, our difficulty in knowing these cultures is this history, and also the fact that we in Europe and the United States today do not know or understand our own cultural history. And therefore, our ignorance of our own history and ignorance of the way we should look at our own history prevents us from understanding what should be understood about the internal history of other cultures.
Take one more question?
Or I'll take another one.
You guys might want to crawl up on that microphone a little bit. It's hard to hear.
Yeah, hi, Lynn. This is Ouyang from Oakland. I'm going for the two for one. So the first is in this Endgame 2005 paper, you said that the hyperinflationary process is kind of self-bounded and is sort of contained, and then it's busted loose, or it's in that process right now.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, because it's not... You know, from what you've written, that's not a result of financial processes per se. I'm somewhat fuzzy in terms of what the relationship between the kind of the subjective element of the decisions being made, and then the relationship between the physical process going on in the economy and then the financial side. So maybe just
right.
Kind of an idea of this self-bounded process. And then real quick, we have this project leading into Franklin's birthday that we've had a few hints dropped on, but we haven't heard much since then. So we have a couple of ideas that, you know, we're looking at the new essays and Franklin's writings and some other things. As far as I can tell, mostly from the idea of trying to look at how individual personalities, Franklin's in particular, but others would project onto this idea of natural law and the development of the nation. So I was just wondering if you had any ideas, guideposts for that project.
Okay. Well, first of all, the problem about the ideas about political economy, accounting, and so forth are a real source of difficulty in understanding processes, number one. Number two, people who think about these processes try to have them explained in mechanistic terms rather than dynamic terms. most people have not yet learned or capable, become, made themselves capable of becoming people who can think in dynamic terms. For example, I said yesterday in responding to commenting on a report or part of a report issued by the CIA on the Iraq issue. I said, well, the fact is that the experts were right, as the CIA report indicated, whereas the facts were wrong. Now, that's typical, because people who say that you have to take the facts and interpret the facts to make a decision are intrinsically incompetent, as in the case of Iraq shows. In this case, selected facts, yes. But when you collect facts, how do you know what you should select? So even though the facts might tend to show the truth, what facts have you selected? What criteria have you used for selecting facts? Whereas the experts, the true experts, those who study a country from a standpoint of its functioning, look at the country from the standpoint of the functioning of the country, not from the so-called collections of facts. And that's what happens is people will say, oh, you say the economy is collapsing, but look, what about the stock market? Isn't the stock market going up? How can you say the economy is collapsing? This was said again the day 2 days ago by the village idiot, Greenspan, to two of our members. He said, how can you say the economy is collapsing when they look at the market? Hey, like the mafioso says, hey, look at the market. And so that's where the facts get screwed up. People go to facts, they select facts, they call facts, and they try to put them together mechanically, like a stochastic function. And no stochastic functions ever tell the truth. So therefore, you have to understand the principle of the dynamics of a process. This gets at this question of how you understand this problem of bounding. And the Riemann's conception of the Dirichlet's principle is key, as I've laid out. A process, as, for example, described as dynamic by Vernadsky in the 1933-35 thing, which I referred to on Vernadsky and Dirichlet's principle, defines this. How does this work? All right, you start with an economy. All economies are primarily physical economies. Physical economies are not the product of financial economies, but rather financial economies are often diseases imposed upon or introduced to physical economies. So physical economy is what? It's people mastering nature as a society, an interactive society, developing the environment, developing themselves, developing the future. Financial processes should be the things we manage according to physical performance criteria of the society as a whole. This is called an American system model of political economy, or it's called a regulated economy, or a protectionist model of economy. And the protection is not so much against outside influences as inside influences, the nuts who want to have a free trade system. Now, what happens when they run a free trade system, which is destroying itself? As long as they can control money, control the behavior of money, so it doesn't explode into a hyperinflationary price explosion, as it has done since spring of this year in the U.S. economy and world economy, then the economy can be managed politically. Because financial systems are not financial systems, they are political systems. That is, political institutions run the economy. And to the extent that the political institutions control the financial system is controlled. Therefore, a smart tyrant running a political system and a financial system will try to control the financial system so it doesn't do the things that mean running out of control. When you get to the point that the system is no longer controllable, by those institutions. Then you get a hyperinflation, and that's what's happened in this case. On the question of Franklin, there are two aspects of Franklin. One thing, first of all, take Graham Lowry's approach to Franklin. That's a good starting point on Franklin in general and on the political Franklin. To understand Franklin as a product of the influence of Leibniz and other things that Graham refers to, remember that the influence of the 15th century Renaissance on Europe in North America was transmitted largely through the Plymouth Brethren and the Massachusetts Bay Colony into what became the United States. So these ideas were there. But then in 1689, with the dictatorship established by the East India Company over Britain and the consolidation of that in 1814 by the establishment of the British monarchy, which meant the British East India Company had taken over, the United States or the Americas were being crushed. And they were being also the development in Europe was being crushed. So therefore, people fled into what became the United States to build it with ideas from Europe. Now, the key thing was the transmission of the ideas of Gottfried Leibniz. This came in two phases. First, you had the Winthrops and Mathers from the 17th century into the 18th century. That was one line. You had an influence by Jonathan Logan, who is with Penn and who is Penn's representative in Pennsylvania. You had then a wave of influence from Europe directed to Franklin, who was then a well-known international physical scientist and an economist. So Franklin as a scientist and economist and as a transmitter of the ideas, political ideas, associated with Leibniz and the Leibnizian movement in the United States with that. The other aspect was the influence of all the emerging culture in North America from the classical Renaissance in Germany, which spilled into places like England to people like Percy Bysshe Shelley and so forth. The spread of the classical culture, which had been revived, the Leibnizian classical culture, revived in Germany around people like Kessner, Lessing, Moses Mendelssohn, Goethe, Schiller, and so forth. That was the other influence. So you have this historical approach which you can take to understand Franklin. I would say that taking the historical approaches into account, the key thing to emphasize is the role of Franklin as a scientist. Now, you had a campaign run from London during the 19th century to attempt to discredit Franklin as a scientist, fraudulently. You had the Newcomb Societies, for example, in the United States, which were for that purpose. Most of what is said about Franklin as a scientist in U.S. literature from 19th century, but also 20th century in particular, is bunk. So, therefore, debunking the debunkers by appreciating Franklin's work as a scientist in the footsteps of Leibniz would be the key thing you might wish to concentrate on.
All right, Lynn, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Have a good time.
Okay, we will.
Okay. Good. Adieu. Au revoir. Au bientôt.